Just going to put the dotted here because then you can see other people's faces. Okay, great. Well, first of all, thank you so much for the warm welcome, Imiru Sensei. It's lovely to see you again and see you in the Zendo in particular. And thank you to everyone who makes it possible to be here, to be practicing here. And yes, so I would like to also start with a bit of a chant, a traditional Theravada chant that we do at the beginning of offering a talk, which is paying homage to the Buddha and taking refuge in the triple jump. So if you know it, you're welcome to join in as well. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namāsāmi. And can somebody tell me what time the talk is supposed to end? So have some sense of
8 o'clock.
8 o'clock. Okay. Is that Q&A, including Q&A?
No, we can have one Q&A open.
Okay. Lovely. So I've been told that the practice period is focused primarily on Ehe Dogen Zenji's fascicle on called Being Time or Uji. And I'm invited to say a little bit about that. And Dogen invites us to investigate the moment. And Uji is a fairly complex investigation of many moments that he uses as examples of how our lives, each one of us as human beings, our lives are full perfect demonstrations of the Dharma. How this human body and mind is both the specifics, the unique, completely incomparable thing that you think of as you, and the universal principles, the aspects of reality that go back as far as the earliest teachings of Buddhism, the very first teachings of the Buddha. And even to say that there are two things is a mistake. But the question for us is, then what? Then how? What is it that Dogen is trying to show us that we might not already see? So as an example, I want to share a phrase, and maybe you have already looked at this phrase from the fascicle. And as I said, it's a fairly complex. A fascicle is just a fancy word for a chapter in a book that's written over a long period of time. Dogen's chapters in his life's work called Shobogenzo, the treasury of the true Dharma eye. These chapters are usually referred to as fascicles because he issued them over his entire teaching career. In any event, so one phrase that I want to have a look at here is classic Dogen, in that he was very much interested in it's called, in Japanese it's called kapatsupachi. Kapatsupachi. Kapatsupachi is the sound that a fish makes when it leaps out of the water. And Dogen said that we, and by that he meant he, use language in order to go beyond language. And he, that's very indicative of the kinds of things that we see in the texts today. So let me just use this particular translation of one phrase from Being Time, in which Dogen says, and this translation is most likely Nichi Jima and Cross. So Shinshu Roberts Sensei, with whom I had the great pleasure of doing quite a bit of practice and actually some study during the time that she was writing this book. I was part of the, what was called the Advanced Dogen Studies Group that met with Shinshu Sensei. And so I don't think that this is her particular translation, although there are a few places in the book where she gives her own, but she based the book primarily on the Nishijima and Cross. The Waddell and Abe translation. Sorry, don't mean to misspeak. I like the Nishijima and Cross actually, but Shinshu likes the Waddell and Abe. So Dogen says this, he says, we think, okay, in English. So bearing in mind that this is our attempt, this is a translator's attempt to wrap their mind around what he's saying. Entirely worlding the entire world with the whole world is thus called penetrating exhaustively. Entirely worlding. So this is just to parse it, to unpack it a little bit, as I understand it, entirely worlding means that the arising, the great activity of our lives. One of my most treasured teachings from my ordination master, my root teacher, Seke Harada Roshi, was learning that my entire life and your entire life is energy, is effort, is activity. And Buddhism is to become awake to that fact and how we might understand the vastness that makes that true, the vastness that is coursing through us as activity. So entirely worlding is the arising or the activity. And the entire world here means specific aspects, specific instances, things that we come into contact with, whether it's inner world or outer world, with the entire world. So that's the conditionality, that's the non-separation of things, the way that the specifics are worked upon by activity because of their interdependence, their conditional on each other. In a way, we can look at the way the emptiness is used in many different ways. If you look at the early Buddhist teachings and you look at the Zen teachings and you look at the Tibetan teachings, for example, there are many different ways in which emptiness is understood. But for the sake of looking at this particular tradition, Zen, Soto Zen, as in its view, you could say that emptiness is pointing at this conditionality because it's saying empty of independent existence or empty of independent arising. So this is part of, this is how we are worlding the entire world. We're worlding the entire world with the whole world, with this interconnection that plays itself out, supported by what? Supported by impermanence. One, if not the most important aspect of unlocking the meaning of a human life. There's a wonderful sutta in which the Buddha talks about many, many different kinds of practice, and he gives kind of a hierarchy of karmic effect or karmic impact of various kinds of teachings. And he sums it up by saying that the perception of impermanence, for as long as it takes to snap your fingers, is of greater impact than 100 other practices you could do karmically, in terms of shifting, in terms of the visceral embodied experience of what it means to be the Dharma. So Dogen says, entirely worlding the entire world with the whole world is thus called penetrating exhaustively. Or I would say in conventional words, no place left out. This is why it's called the nature of things, because there's no place where it's not operating in that way. Again, inner world or outer world, so-called inner world or outer world. And this has this, just this one phrase has a number of implications for us as practitioners, for implications for us as people who are living within the wisdom of Buddhism and the compassion of Buddhism. So one aspect is you are never alone. There is no such thing as doing anything alone, because the entire world is worlding. The entire world is worlding. And I was going to tell you one set of stories, but before that, I'm going to tell you a slightly different story, actually, spontaneously, now that I say that part about not doing things alone. So it was New Year's Day at Tassajara. Tassajara is a Zen monastery, part of San Francisco Zen Center, a group of temples in the Ventana Wilderness, about, I'm not good at geography, but let's say 2 hours or so inland of Carmel, California. So that means on New Year's Day, it's not snowing or all that cold usually. And so I went out for a walk on the trail because we didn't have the regular schedule. It was New Year's Day, so we had an abbreviated schedule in the Zendo that day. And I went out for a walk on the trail that leads up to the place where Suzuki Roshi is buried. The Suzuki Roshi Memorial Site is kind of over the hill and back beyond where the bathhouse is. And then you can go over that little hill and there's a place where you can quite easily get to Tassajara Creek. And I thought, oh, that'd be nice. I'd like to go and just see the creek. You know, I'm not a big hiker. I'm not one of these people going out for hours and hours. So I went out there and I got to I stood at the edge of the creek, and the creek was fairly low. And it was a beautiful day, sunny, clear. I'm standing there. And this little fish jumps up on a rock. Jumps up on a rock right next to my foot. Right? Speaking of Kapatsupachi, I didn't hear it necessarily. But the little fish did hop right out of the water and land on the rock next to my foot. And I took a look at the fish there, and it took me a few minutes to realize that the little fish wasn't hopping right back in the creek. And so then I was faced with the moment. Like, okay, somehow I'm going to have to help this little being to get back into the creek. And I didn't think about it much. I just leaned right down and tried to pick up the fish and put him back. Right? But no, 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 no. The little fish was not having any of it. Right? It squirmed and looked and it, and I didn't want to squeeze it too much because if you hurt it, then there's no point in putting it back. Right? I don't want to hurt the little creature. So I tried several times to pick up the little fish, but no deal. No deal. So then I had to stop again for a moment and think about what was going on and whether I might be able to help, because by now the fish, you know, it has its mouth open and it's, you can tell it's kind of gasping for air. So now we have like a life and death moment here on a small scale, on a relatively small scale. Huge scale for that fish, but small scale in terms of my human life. And I thought to myself, now I'm somebody who's, I've had fish tanks. I've, you know, I've seen other people's fish tanks. I've seen fish in natural settings. I think that I know that fish need water. The fish needs to get back into the water. And then I get this idea. Oh, I get it. Fish need water. And I scoop some water and scoop some fish, and all in one swoop, whoosh, the little fish goes back in. Yay, a happy moment. One small win on New Year's Day. We're happy. I'm happy, thrilled. Hopefully, I think the fish is thrilled. It swims, swish, right back into the creek. Gone before I could even turn around. And I have told this story many times because I think there are so many beautiful teachings within that moment. And for me, it was such a sense of joy. But one particular teaching that I want to call out from this is two particular teachings actually that I want to call out from this is, it, even though I'm stronger than the fish, I'm smarter than the fish, I supposedly understand fish, I can't help the fish until I'm in harmony with the fish. Up until that point, there's no amount of effort that's going to help, actually. Until I understand my harmony with the fish and actually working together with what the little fish wanted, because obviously the little fish wanted something other than what I had been doing up until that point. And the second teaching of this, the second part of this, is the difference between an intellectual knowing that fish need water and a visceral lived experience of that in the moment. What is it to be a being that lives in water? And that is really what Dogen is pointing to when he talks to us in Uji about exhaustively penetrating. So there's this deep intrinsic interconnection. And yet for it to manifest, there is also a way in which we must realize it for ourselves. We must realize it for ourselves. And it's not sufficient just to say the whole thing is all one. I also want to say that. Not at all. In fact, it's funny because one time I was giving a talk about the non-dual and I said something like, you know, all things are mere phenomena acted upon by the principles of reality. And then somebody raised their hand and they said, well, but if you hit somebody with a stick, that's different than if you give them an ice cream. Right? And the answer is, yes, that's true. That's true. But what I want to say about that is it's true, and yet you cannot tell which is better except by the conditions themselves. So in Zen, particularly in the temple that I was trained in, one of the temples that I was trained in Japan, we use something called a kyosoku. It's a stick that's used to hit people for beneficial purposes. It's used to, you can, in the temple that I was in, you mostly had the opportunity to request it or not. And it's used to hit people on the shoulders to kind of wake you up or to loosen your muscles or just to get the energy flowing. Super helpful. At least I found it super helpful. I don't think you're using the kyosoku. Most Western sanghas don't do it for various reasons that are compassionate, I would say. But in Zen, sometimes you hit somebody with a stick for a good reason, in a beneficial way, right? Or you can hit somebody with a stick and it's violence, right? It's violence. And in terms of the ice cream, me, if you give me an ice cream, I'm happy. As long as it's before 12 o'clock in the afternoon, because I cannot eat that after hours. That's the promise that I have made. That is the monastic vow. That's how it works. We don't eat dinner. We don't eat anything except for certain things called the laudables between the midday and the dawn of the next day. So if you give me an ice cream, I'm thrilled. I'm happy, like it. But that's because I have a body that will deal with it. Some people don't have that. When I was a young mom, my daughter, I decided to throw a little party for her at the daycare. And I brought all the little kids at the daycare a little cup of ice cream. And then I started putting it down in front of all the kids. And then the teacher, the preschool teacher walked up to me. She's like, no, no, this little guy, he can't have it. He's lactose intolerant. So she picks up the ice cream that I had just set down in front of him so that he doesn't start eating it. And the poor little guy started sobbing, right? Because he doesn't understand that it's harmful to his body yet. Eventually he probably will. But for him, an ice cream, not such a good thing. So I say these things to say the causes and conditions are what make the thing it is. Whether it's you as a human being or a particular activity. And we have the precepts as a way of helping to point us, for example, at various causes and conditions that can be harmful or that can be more beneficial. But ultimately, the Bodhisattva vows only make sense in the context that we do our best to really, to fully exhaustively penetrate that interconnection. To find the inherent harmony that is there. And then to find the harmlessness that goes with that. So now I've got a lot more things that I wanted to share. So I'm just going to keep going from there and we'll see how far we get. So viewed from this vantage point, just to whirl all the way back to time, what is Dogen trying to say about time? Well, he says, viewed from this vantage point of individual moments and individual sets of conditions, then each set of conditions is a moment. It's a time. And we tell time by comparing different sets of conditions, conventionally. That's all. We don't need to overthink it. Because of impermanence, because of interconnection, because of each instant, faster than I can even say it, is gone. And then there is another instant of a particular kind of existence, and that is a moment. So again, the good news, bad news, right? We live right there in the midst of it, and yet oftentimes there's something that we're missing. We are not awake to this. We are not realizing this reality. We are, in fact, at great odds with this reality. So I would suggest that what Buddhism is telling us, what Zen especially is telling us, is that these bodies that we are living in are our best chance of realizing this, of finding the place where that vastness, where those truths are coursing in our lives. That's my, according to me, my suggestion is that's why Zen is so ritualized. That's why we have all of these teachings about forms. To bring this embodied existence into beautiful focus. And start to make sense of this activity, this great activity of worlding the world. Where is it? How is it? So I'll leave you just with a couple of words and then we'll go on to the Q&A. So Heejin Kim is a fabulous Dogen scholar. If you get a chance to read any of his materials, he's a very, very complex thinker, but I think a person who understands Dogen well, who understands the essence of what Dogen was trying to say. In any event, he translates also one of the phrases from Ujjayi Sangha's activity, and I'm paraphrasing because there's a chunk of the sentence that's taken out and I don't have it here. Activity is every human's only true refuge. So going back to what I said earlier, this very life, this whole life is activity. And how is it that it becomes your true refuge? Zazen is to discover that. Zazen is to live and abide right in the midst of that and see how it's always telling you all the time anyway, whether you're listening or not. How this life is always telling you what the principles of Dharma really are. And when you actually listen well, then that is when you can experience what Dogen called dropping off of the self, or dropping off of the sense of time, the linear sense of time. To be so at one with it, that there's no sense of separation. There's no sense of two anymore. And when that happens, then you won't be swept away by the ice cream. And you won't be missing out on saving the fish. And you will do what Dogen said, when you lead the way to the way, you attain the way. Lead the way to the way, you attain the way. Because it's nowhere else than right here. Right there. Thank you. So